This is Decentralized, the Decentralized Trials and Research Podcast. We gather here with friends and guests to talk about the latest ways to make research and clinical trials around the world more inclusive, more accessible, more resilient, and more sustainable, all by using decentralized methods. This podcast is recorded live on Clubhouse every Friday, 12 to 1 Eastern, on the TGIF DCT show at the Decentralized Trials Club. You can join the live sessions and add your voice every Friday at noon Eastern time with the free Clubhouse app by following the Decentralized Trials Club. And of course, subscribe to this podcast on your favorite platform to get notified of new episodes. Following the club and subscribing will also help you stay current for any of the bonus content we may drop. And now, it's time to decentralize. Hello and welcome to this week's gathering of TGIF DTRA. We do gather here on Fridays to chat live with friends that are working on helping to make clinical trial participation more accessible for all. This week, we are streaming live on our usual Friday, but with the express purpose of dropping some exciting, relevant content to celebrate and mark Clinical Trials Day 2025. Clinical Trials Day is on May 20th. So if you are watching the replay, the stream of this, happy Clinical Trials Day to you all. If you're wondering why are we talking about Clinical Trials Day on May 20th, this is meant to be a commemoration of way back in 1747 when James Lind ran what is often viewed as the first controlled clinical trial looking at treatment options for scurvy. But today, if you haven't already, be sure to click on clinicaltrialsday.org. This is a website created by and maintained by our friends at ACRP. This year, that is being sponsored with groups like Advara and Merck and Sanofi, Thermo Fisher and Velocity. And from the clinicaltrialsday.org site, you can download a Share Your Purpose selfie sign and help to mark the day. So enjoy today's gathering here and be sure to participate and help to raise awareness and celebrate your reason why you participate here. Well, Jane, we've got some special friends who individually are all fabulous people and working on cool things, but there is a common thread for today's conversation. Jane, do you want to share with folks what is the connection that we have?
Sure. So we're really lucky to have some experts in the room with us today who have actually not just designed and executed clinical trials, but they've shifted their role to become clinical trial participants in other trials. So not the trials they designed and executed, but trials for other organizations. And when Craig and I were thinking about Clinical Trials Day and really celebrating our why, we thought it would be interesting to talk to some of those folks and really hear from them. What was that like to be the participant? How did it change your thinking? And what did you start to advocate for back in your professional role based on what happened in the trial? So Craig and I are also clinical trial participants. But I think this is going to be really fun. And I think that I'm just going to put it out there at the beginning and we'll probably come back to it at the end. I'm making a call to action that if you're in clinical research and you haven't been in a clinical trial, do everything you can to get into one, because for me, it was a pivotal and frame-shifting experience.
I am a wickedly non-compliant research participant, and I really look forward to chatting about the irony of why I am. But let's jump in. We've got three special guests with us here today. If you saw some of our promos, we did have a fourth. And so we're sending our get well wishes to our friend Jim Kramitis. who many of you know in this field. And I was going to call him out as well because Jim was the past executive director for ACRP, which has taken ownership for championing Clinical Trials Day. We'll miss Jim today. But fortunately, we have three other really remarkable individuals who I truly r admire and find inspiration from in this field. And so it is not a surprise to me that all three of them have themselves been participants in research. Tertu, maybe we can start with you. If you don't mind, just introduce yourself. What is it you do by day for folks? And then maybe set up for us a bit on what clinical trial participant journey you went down.
No, thank you. Happy Friday, everyone. And I'm really looking forward to the exciting week for the Clinical Trial Awareness Week that we'll have all of next week. While Jane was making the introduction, I realized, and of course I know this, but I started in the industry having a medical background as an investigator. So I've been both an investigator and a participant to trials. And I must say, the fact that I was an investigator at the start is something I carried forward in my career over the years in the different roles that I had. And today I am extremely fortunate to be my day job is to lead one of the largest pharma companies in their effort to be highly engaged to sites and patients in our R&D part of the organization. And it is absolutely a sort of the investigator voice I've always carried in all of the 25 years. I became a clinical trial participant in the pandemic, during the pandemic, when a clinical trial for efficacy of vaccines in patients taking immunosuppressants was calling for healthy control group. So I joined as a healthy control group in a trial where the patients, so to speak, were mostly people on the rheumatoid arthritis, psoriasis, atopic dermatitis scope using biologics for their treatments. And I joined as a healthy control group. And I must admit, Greg, like you, I dropped out and I was non-compliant, and I'm happy to share why that all is. So that's the story. And I think the trial that I was in lasted for about 3 years. So it was not a one and done. It was a long, long trial.
Wow, we're going to have a theme here about clinical trial dropouts from industry. Tertu, it's great to have you here. As you point out, you are one of those unique folks that has transcended pharma, service provider, investigator, participant. And so I'm sure this lends to a very nice surround sound of perspective today. And I really look forward to digging in about what worked for you as a trial participant and what clearly did not.
And what happens at my kitchen table?
Ms. Alicia Staley, it is truly an honor to have you back here. If there's somebody out there in the Ethernet that doesn't know you, could you just introduce a little bit about who you are and
Sure.
what was your journey as well around clinical research participation?
Sure. First of all, thank you for having me. I always love hanging out with the DTRA crew on Friday. So I appreciate the invite. For those that don't know me, my name's Alicia Staley. I'm the Chief Patient Officer at Medidata, and I am a three-time cancer survivor. So my journey through clinical research actually started before I got into this industry, and I guess I can say because of my experience as a cancer survivor and some of the trials and tribulations I had through my cancer journey, this is really how I ended up in this industry. So I was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma when I was a sophomore in college, went through treatment, took about 3.5 years to go through multiple courses of treatment to actually get rid of the Hodgkin's disease. I was interestingly enough presented with a clinical trial opportunity. As a 19-year-old, I needed to have my parents essentially sign off on the clinical trial experience as my parents, and we could not figure out, we couldn't make our way through the informed consent forms that they had provided us around the clinical trial experience. It just was very difficult for us to understand what the outcome for me would be, or what the benefit for me would be participating in the trial. And I ended up sort of, we made the de decision as a family to stay with standard course of treatment at the time for Hodgkin's disease. And I like to point out that at that moment in time, my parents, who were going through the documentation for this informed consent, were dual master's degrees, highly educated individuals. And I just remember the look on my mother's face, trying to figure out if this was a good decision for her, essentially her child, her young adult, to undertake. That there was just there was something about that experience that really stuck with me, and I don't think I realized what a profound impact that would have on the course of my life for many different reasons. I was subsequently diagnosed with breast cancer in 2004, and again in 2008, as a direct result of all the radiation I had for the Hodgkin's lymphoma. So I like to say it's the gift that keeps on giving. but obviously, I've developed a sense of humor about it at this point. But at that time, I was actually presented a number of other opportunities to participate in clinical research, and decided to participate in a med device clinical trial going through my first breast cancer treatment, because in all honesty, I feel it's because I'm an engineer. And when I was looking at the med device informed consent, it was very visual. They had schematics, they had diagrams, they were very explicit about what the makeup of this med device would be, the function of the med device. I actually felt I really understood it. And I really think that that was the only reason why I chose to participate in that trial. It was just, it was the way that it was presented to me, and my understanding of what they were asking as part of that trial. About, I'd say 15 years ago, after everything I had been through, I really decided that change was needed in healthcare, particularly in oncology, when it came to the patient experience. Was really frustrated at seeing how technology seemed to be making its way through other industries in a rapid innovation cycles, or financial services in particular. You can trade stocks on your phone, you can buy Bitcoin, you can do all these great things. But I was still going into the cancer center and basically filling out a piece of paper on a clipboard that had my name, what my symptoms were since my last visit. And I thought, this is absolutely ridiculous. And I think I became sort of this one woman, like, angry cancer survivor that decided the experience needed to change. So here I am, happy to participate in Clinical Trials Day, content building to just really shine the light on opportunities for us as an industry to continue to push the needle and make the experience better for patients. Just there is always an opportunity to do better. And taking a moment to pause every year around Clinical Trials Day, I think, is a wonderful reminder to everybody that works in this industry that there's more to this than just a job. This is really a mission. This is really a purpose that we're stepping into to helping. So that's my story.
Alicia,
Hey,
we're
Alicia.
grateful. Oh.
I'm just saying the clipboard still happens at this big treatment
Oh, yeah.
hospital that I go to down the road from where I live in NorCal.
Yeah, it always does. I had a checkup a couple weeks ago, and they gave me a clipboard, and I just looked at them. I'm like, you guys are kidding me. Like, what? Seriously?
Did you drop a, do you know who I am?
I did. I said, listen, guys. Don't make me
No.
come back to the Patient Family Advisory Council.
Alicia, we are very grateful to have your voice in this field in general. I think back
Thank
to my
you.
days at Pfizer and
Yeah.
opportunities where you came in to help our teams with insights even before your full-time professional journey in this space. And so that voice has brought impact here for quite some time. Thanks, Alicia. And I'm
Thank you,
looking
Craig.
forward to digging in more in this conversation about this twofold impact of the informed consent process, how it could, chase a patient away or could pull a patient in. Well, our third guest takes the name Craig and does something constructive and good with it, as compared to the value that I bring to the name and brand. So, Craig, Sarah, it is always wonderful to have you here, my friend. For folks that haven't had the pleasure, who is Craig, Sarah, and what is your intersection with clinical research participation?
Yes, thank you, Craig. And this is truly a last is definitely least with Tertu and Alicia, and them sharing their stories. So for those that don't know me, Craig Serra, I have been in and around the industry for 20 something years. Most recently, helped build up a clinical research business at Flatiron Health. My trial story is one along with another 46,330 that participated in the pivotal phase 2/3 COMIRNATY study for Pfizer back in the pandemic days. I think we remember those days. So that was quite an interesting time, obviously, for all of us. And when the opportunity came up for a potential vaccine, and then, of course, a potential trial for that potential vaccine, I jumped at the chance to volunteer along with a whole bunch of other people. Interestingly, in that journey, it was I too claimed to be a dropout. It was there was lots known about what a vaccine could do. I did not get any of the sort of injection site reactions, so I was functionally unblinded, knowing I got the placebo, and so I didn't want to give lots and lots of blood on repeat visits an hour away, so I dropped out of the trial. No fault of the way the study is designed, just that's the way it was. It was a little bit like the old commercials for Hair Club for Men, like not just the president, also a client, because I was using software and there were processes in place that several years prior I had helped implement at Pfizer. And so I was both thanking and cursing myself. So more about that in a little bit. But yes, it was quite the journey. But I will say, just to give shout out to my grandmother, who was in a trial for verapamil back in the day, and then my mom, who was in a trial for the adhesive that's used on Band-Aids, and then my daughter, who's a cancer survivor, who's in a trial or registry technically for her cancer. So I suppose it runs in the family of being very clinical research oriented. But yes, nice to join you. Good to see everyone.
Thanks so much, Craig, for the intro. Thanks also, you've got that also that surround sound perspective with these different roles that you played. But it'll be interesting in our conversation also to think about, both your experience and, maybe there are design considerations that actually could have kept you participating, but also, as a father, of a child that's had her cancer battle, and even just to speculate on what would be that threshold of participation that you and a family would be considering here. Thanks so much. Now, Jane, you hinted at that you and I have been participants ourselves. What's your story here, Jane?
I was in the same trial as Craig. That was, but I had already been in the Project Baseline trial by that time. And some of you might have known about Project Baseline. It was a huge trial that was run by Verily. It was a non-interventional trial in that there was no specific treatment. But it was a 5-year trial, and I can say I've never been as thoroughly examined in my entire clinical history as I was as part of the entry and follow-up visits for that trial. I remember reading the informed consent at DPharm, actually, and seeing that they told you to expect 8-hour days on site at Stanford. And I remember laughing, like, no, that's not possible. It's non-interventional. Well, yes, they were 8-hour days. But it was awesome because in that trial, I got to experience multiple devices. I got to experience the 6-minute walk test. I got to experience all the pulmonary function tests that you would do in many other domains of clinical research, had full echocardiograms. Like, it was intense. But the really cool thing was some of those data points actually ended up getting used with my clinicians back in my regular healthcare, which is not something clinical trials are good at. And we'll just park it there. But let's just say that knowing a little bit about how trials work made that possible for me. Again, I will advocate if you can do this, it's so worth it to learn how it feels to be the person rolling up your sleeve, literally. Right, Craig?
Well, I'd love to start this conversation just around this theme about non-compliance and dropouts and how much of that is a consequence of design or missed expectations. My experience in research has been as a patient with sarcoidosis. I'm in a research study that is conducted at an academic medical center in Midtown Manhattan. And I talked about this with the investigator and coordinator when we were doing the consent process. Blood draws for me would represent a 4-hour round trip, a $40 to $50 cost for getting in and out, just for a blood draw. And Lord knows how many phlebotomy centers I would be passing on that commute in each direction. And yet, no process exists in that study. This is like irony, right? Enrolling me in a trial that has no local options or flexibility around where just a routine specimen is collected. And so when it comes to those follow-ups, I am a compliance disaster for them. Tertu, you mentioned that for you, compliance was an issue and that you ultimately withdrew. So share with us a bit more about, was there a miss there around communication? Did the burden exceed your expectation? And are there some design considerations that have impacted your thinking here?
Yeah, no, thanks. Thanks, Greg. And wow, such impressive stories around the table. I feel like I've just done something really simple in that. But so the trial that I participated in was not a pharma sponsored trial. So it was a academic trial. And when I got the informed consent of a page and a half, I was blown away. I was like, okay, so this is all it takes to do an academic trial with a registered product, but with a very, very, very valid research question, a scientific question to answer, because we were at the beginning. It was really like the first, basically, it allowed me to get the vaccine with the like very first wave of healthcare workers and people at higher risk that were getting the vaccine initially. So it was, of course, an extremely relevant question in the pandemic. How are all those people that are using biologics, how are they going to respond? What is their immune response going to be? So it only took a page and a half of informed consent. The staff was all great. I had to go to one of the big academic centers in Amsterdam to sign up and participate. And I had done like the pre-screening online, and it was really, really well organized and a lovely experience. And then came the follow-ups in the very true spirit of decentralization. Everything else was virtual, which meant that I had questionnaires, all fine. And again, I was a control person, so and I knew exactly the person I was a control to. So we were doing things together, like, oh, we get the questionnaire at the same time, and or bit well, not literally one to one, but like people were asked, patients were asked, can you recruit your control the control group? And then the fun things are, because they wanted, of course, blood samples. And in a true virtual fashion, we were asked to collect our own blood samples. So that's where the kitchen table comes in. which for me, with a medical background, was already, it was quite interesting. And remember, this is also the time before everybody was really used to doing their own COVID self-testing. So I got this like big envelope with the kits and the instructions, and you have to, and even like an alcohol wipe and the lens to get, but also with the instructions that the sample had to be in the lab within 24 hours. So please make sure you put it in the mail before the mail is taken away on that day, because it needs to be at the lab the next day. Don't do this on a Thursday, because if we miss the mail on Friday, don't do it on a Friday, don't do it on a da 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 da. And it was those kind of like logistics that already made me late, I think, and it came every other week, every other week. So just the like the burden on my daily schedule, which is nothing when I think about the real trials that we do, was already difficult for me to integrate in my daily life. How do I make sure that I get to the mail before 3 p.m.? I think I did it for a year and a half, and then I started to miss more and more samples just because of like, oh, motivation, et cetera, et cetera. So that was the reason I dropped out. But I can also tell a lot of really great things about this trial. And the interesting thing was that the patients, so the patient side arm of the trial, they realized really, really quickly that especially rheumatoid arthritis patients, they couldn't handle at all the like tiny tube and the like the fine motor skills were just not up to par. So the patients were given the option to get a phlebotomy at their clinic, but not the healthy control group, which was interesting. So
Really
that's what they did
interesting
at my
takeaways. I
kitchen
feel like you
table.
and I had kind of like parallel lives here in that, that it so much of it linked to just specimen collection. And, maybe in your case, folks were trying to be creative and agile, but was that tested? Was that kind of walked through? Was there almost a lived experience to sort of for that team to really understand the burden that maybe what they thought was a clever workaround would actually introduce?
And I know I messed up the data collection also, because it is, as I said, every 2 weeks. But when things got a bit more, when I got a bit more sloppy, I didn't realize that the kits that I had that I received were linked to an online questionnaire that I was filling out. So at a certain point, I got like emails and or the any investigator phoned me like, we don't know when you took the questionnaire because the sample barcode doesn't link to the and I was like, but if you would have told me that there is, I don't know, questionnaire number 10 and this is sample number 10, and even if you've missed number 9, please use this kit for number 10, that would have made a huge difference on the quality of the data. Very simple. And I discussed all these things. So I did out myself as a expert on clinical trials, and I had lovely conversations with the investigators.
We have this friend, I think she's been on this show, Sarah Krug is a patient advocate, and she's written quite a bit on patient confessionals and patient confessions. Having patients share stories of the times that they have actively lied or misled their healthcare providers out of their own self-interest or for a host of different reasons. I feel like we're having our own confessional of research professionals who have been non-compliant research participants. And so, Tertu, you'll let us know if you need a voice changer or a blue dot over your face as we continue the conversation here. Let's continue down that thread, Craig. So you too were a research dropout. Was that primarily because you knew which treatment arm you were on, and at this point in the pandemic, it was about vaccine access, or were there other barriers that started to creep their way in here?
Yeah, I think the kind of the main headline was, well, I didn't get the vaccine. So that's why I was in the study. I think we some people have short memories of just how bad the pandemic was, and so trying to get access to something that was going to be effective was just incredibly important. And so in losing access to that, at least immediate access to that, it became, okay, well, why should I stay in the trial? The very, very similar, it was very logistics related of why I didn't. It became, it was about an hour trip to the site. I believe there were two, I'm in northern Jersey, and I believe there were two sites in all of New Jersey that were open to enrollment. The closest one was an hour away, oddly enough, owned by and run by someone that I knew and had previously been at Pfizer. That was the only reason I even found out about it to begin with, which is a separate thing. But the other aspect, very similar, was the sheer amount of blood draws, the sheer amount of the ePro stuff didn't bother me too much, but the sheer amount of blood draws, the sheer amount of trips, all laid out in the visit schedule. I had access to it via the informed consent, but it was something that you don't pay much attention to. And look, this is healthy volunteer, so this is you sort of have your you have your options here. This is not a non-healthy volunteer. It's not a cancer trial. I was just talking to a family friend this morning who's actually enrolling in a trial today for endometrial cancer. I want to not equate the two worlds. At the same time, as Chitu said, I mean, a lot of the trials that we run, the population, the participant population, they have a lot going on. They have the disease they're living with, and then they have to live life. And then they also have to get into a trial or be or stay in a trial that requires a lot of them. And so, I looked at it, long story made longer, is I looked at it as what is actually going to be the benefit of me staying in the trial? And to be quite fair, and this is without any regard to powering of the trial, but I looked at the other 46,000 some odd people that were in the trial and thought, you know what, I think I'm maybe biased a little bit coming from industry, and I think a lot of people are probably staying in the trial that got placebo. So I felt comfortable dropping out, thinking that there would be plenty of people to power the trial, and luckily that was the case. But the yeah, the logistics of it, the burden of it. I think for what it's worth, I should say, Pfizer did a great job of designing the trial, and I think they did a great job, especially in the, in the middle of a pandemic, working at quote unquote, warp speed. They did a phenomenal job of actually getting sites opened and getting participants enrolled. In a calmer time, I think I would probably have a heavier hand in terms of criticism, but it really was, I think, rolled out in the best way possible from some very, very well-meaning people.
This experience of yours is hardly unusual. There were Facebook groups during the vaccine trials during the pandemic where participants were sharing tips and tricks on how to get your viral load checked or to do different types of assays at your local Walgreens and how to interpret if you were inactive or not. And certainly at a time like that, with a pandemic raging, to be told that, well, you're in the control arm and you'll just have to wait for your vaccine, certainly would represent a barrier for many. But it's also hardly unusual outside of, a pandemic. And it causes me to reflect on, an experience that I watched with Vertex's telaprevir trials and hepatitis C, and how even there, patients were able to, through communities, able to start to determine and share tips and tricks on how to get tested at providers' offices that were not participating in the study, how to interpret your viral load to see if you are on active or control, and sparked really interesting debates in online communities where the participants were discussing, do we stay or do we ditch? I know I'm in the control arm. Is it really worth the effort for me at this stage? So I think you're raising some really interesting points that can feel unique to a vaccine control arm in a pandemic, but maybe are pretty generalizable for the way a lot of patients will consider staying in the trial. Stales, you were describing, sorry, that's, is that still your ex, your Twitter handle?
Oh yeah, I'm never gonna be able to get rid of it, so
No, I'll forever call you
yeah.
that as a result. The trial you were in was a device trial, and you see
Yeah.
a lot of drug trials. Is the
Yeah.
was the burden and demand different in a device trial, or was its burden almost inconsequential because it sort of coexisted with you managing, a breast cancer diagnosis and the
Yeah.
treatment you're already dealing with?
I think, well, that's an interesting question because it was there was surgery involved as part of the participation in the trial to actually have the device in. So the device was essentially they would thread a like a saline balloon into the tumor cavity. They would drop the radiation seeds into it, very similar to like the brachytherapy that they use in other kinds of cancers. And so the burden or the lift, I guess, for participation was you had to agree to do two additional surgeries, actually three additional surgeries, two prep surgeries and a removal surgery. And my in-trial experience ended up being very, very difficult. It was very hard. Physically, the treatment was ended up being much more intense than I thought it would be. So I ended up having some side effects from the treatment itself that were pretty substantial. And that was one of the conversations that I had had with the care team was I didn't, well, I understood the mechanism of what they were doing, and that's exactly why I felt comfortable participating in the experience. They were not really clear on potential side effects or what could go wrong, essentially. And unfortunately, I dealt with a lot of the stuff that ended up going wrong. And it made it difficult to look at it and not think of ways that the informed consent or discussions should have happened to be m much more clear about intended, potential pitfalls. So I think I was in a it was a very unique experience that I think now today when I look at informed consents of any kind, I almost look at it from the negative first. What I almost look at the white space, if you will, like what hasn't been articulated that we really should think about. How bad can these side effects really get? And are we doing the patients, are we giving them enough information to really understand? Hopefully
You're so,
that makes it oh, go ahead, sorry.
no, there's some really interesting themes that
Yeah.
are popping through really loud and clear for me here. And one of them is clearly around the informed consent process. And your
Yeah.
examples and your stories clearly hit home there. The first trial as a teenager where the family just didn't even understand
Yeah.
the
We
value and the
didn't
story
know.
despite being highly educated. This example with the device study where the visual rendering in the consent made it appealing, but
Yeah.
ultimately the realities of the trial participation didn't seem to re be reflective of the
No.
information that you were presented with.
Yeah.
In parallel, we're hearing a lot about burden of certain procedures, particularly around phlebotomy in trial participation. But it's also interesting to me how, when we're hearing these stories about burden of participation, it makes me think about that call to action and that pull back to the research community.
Yeah.
Very often we've seen some companies take these incremental steps towards simulation, right? We'll do a boardroom exercise to play out what a visit looks like. Maybe we'll go to a site and we'll walk through a visit together. But is that really insufficient for the examples we're talking about here? Do we almost need the study team to wear the participant badge for a cycle or two and to really go through? Because if they just paid a visit to a site to walk through a visit, they wouldn't see that experience of every other week, you want me to carve out a Monday and do this blood draw at my kitchen table and then run to the post office. Like, let's see you do that every other week and see how that impacts you, to really start to walk the walk, like Jane was saying, and to live that experience. Are you seeing companies start to progress how they're thinking about simulation and kind of walking through that, or are we still just like boardroom plus at this stage?
From my perspective, in the work that I'm doing, we're definitely starting to see that. We're definitely trying to model what these experiences can look like. We're also trying to look and really get down to a very detailed level around the concept of burden. So if you're looking at the schedule of activities and you can pull out every single thing that is a patient might go through in the context of the trial experience, and there's ways to make assessments on how patients are going to respond to, 15 blood draws over, X amount of time. You can start to qualify and quantify that and look at patient burden in a new way. And we've been doing this for a while at Medidata, and I think that that's so, the way that I approach it is data tells a story, right? And we have to have people that are listening to that story to be able to act on it in a way that makes sense for the patients. So if we're asking patients to do X amount of stuff over a very short period of time, and that there is some sort of pain or there is some sort of emotional or physical impact, we need to start considering that. One of the conversations that I had in my example with the med device was, I said, why wasn't it clearly articulated that, that essentially the skin potentially could burn from the inside out? Like, why didn't you put that in the informed consent? They're like, well, we're not, you had a very rare side effect. And I said, well, there's a way to talk about, radiation damage that can alert the patient to something that potentially could go wrong, but without scaring them out of the trial experience. I said, you've got to balance the information that is necessary to allow the patient to make a good informed decision or be prepared for something that could go wrong. And I think, to get back to what you're saying, is there a way to model that stuff? I think by taking it down to such a discrete level, almost like activity by activity, and looking at, you have to look at that each activity, give it a score, and then look at it as a cumulative over the context of the whole trial. And maybe if you go one event by one event and say, all right, I can handle that, I can handle that. But can you handle that over 7 weeks or 5 straight days of having your insides, radiated from the inside out? Like, there, you get to a point where you're like, I gotta stop, or like, this is physically too much, and I can't do this anymore. And when a patient sort of raises their hand and says that, absolutely, the research teams are going to respond to that. But at the same time, we've got to get smarter about thinking about, we shouldn't be putting patients in those kinds of scenarios from the get-go. Is there a way to use the data to tell a story that makes sense for the objectives that we've got to achieve for this trial and do it in a way that makes sense? That doesn't really burn out the patient, no pun intended, doesn't burn out the patient. See, I told you I got to have a sense of humor about this at this point. But we've got to be mindful of the what we're asking people to do, and make sure that if we're going to really, really push on the patients to get them through this trial, the support better be there,
I'm going to chime
Yeah.
in here for a sec because thank you for sharing that story, Alicia. And it resonates so closely for me this spring, not because I'm in a trial, but because I've been supporting somebody who's going
Yeah.
through a CAR-T trial. And It has been enlightening as her part of her support team, not clinically, just emotionally, to watch her process what was in her understanding from the consent, and then how it felt to go through the process. So she's awesome. I'm thrilled she got to do this, but she would tell you she really did not understand how intense this pre-treatment ablation process would be before she received her reinfusion of cells. She did not understand how fatigued she would be while she was in the hospital after the reinfusion. So all of it has gone the way that was expected. It's just that it's such a gap between what she imagined it would be and what the reality required. So now I'm going to make a call out to Justin, who's here with us, because one of the things we're thinking about, and I won't stay too long on this, is neither the patients nor the sites seem to get a good visual picture of how the trial is going to happen in a way that is not siloed by activity. And so we're trying to think through how could you make it clearer for both sites and patients what's going to happen within each visit instead of by specific assessment. What does that look like as a whole so that you can start to understand it? It's not just the 4-hour infusion, it's the 4-hour infusion and the 2-hour wait time so that then we can draw your, you know. But Justin's working on that with us on a project, and I'm super excited about that because I think we're just doing a not ideal job at clarifying how it all fits together for either party.
Yeah, and Jane, I don't have any novel thoughts on the subject, but I'm glad you brought it up. You know that just the concept of looking at trial design visit by visit as we're assessing decentralization opportunities is a real big and important thing to me. But you're, I think, you know, I was going to say the next step, but it doesn't even need to be next. You know, a parallel concept is communicating that to the patient, because you're right, thinking about, hey, I have six blood draws is one thing, or thinking about, oh, I have six visits is something, but thinking about, like, here are all the things that have to happen at this visit, times the number of visits, and how those time up with each other. I mean, a long standing. So I will say, as somebody that's worked in research for 21 years, but has only been in the human subject side for about six, I had done double digit clinical trial participations before I ever, you know, saw a study protocol from the study team side. And one of the biggest things that always really burns me is when I see study activities or either burden or discomfort, whatever, being downplayed in an ICF. I mean, it's one thing to kind of minimize the discomfort that a muscle biopsy is going to cause. That to me is like is blatantly intentional. It's not intentional, but it's equally as misleading to not give a patient or a participant the full concept of what they're really signing up for and what each of those visits is going to mean from a burden perspective in their life. So I think, you know, part of it is design to minimize that burden, but we also need to think about communication. How are we telling the patients what this is going to entail?
And I think being open-minded to that all patients are going to have, you know, their experience is on a relative scale, right? You know, we have no, like, everybody, you know, deals with pain and on different levels and different scales. And some people have much higher tolerance for pain than other patients. And, you know, I think after everything I've been through, my tolerance for pain is pretty high. And for me to be the patient to raise my hand and say, you know, enough is enough, you know, I can't even imagine the impact that must have on some patients that might not have the kind of mindset that I had going into that experience. And I think you're absolutely right that if you don't consider it in the totality, you know, we're doing a disservice to the experience for everybody involved.
Yeah,
By the way, just for folks that heard his voice but don't know who that was, Justin Gundelach is the program manager for decentralized clinical trial enablement at the Mayo Clinic. Thank you, Justin. Sorry, Tertu, go ahead.
No, I think these are all such great comments, and I think the comment about the, I mean, the control group, why would I stay, the is the treatment bearable? Those are related to the science. And one thing that I maybe want to highlight is that operations for the from the patient perspective were for me the make or break. So I told the investigator, I went back to them and I said, if you would have written in that an additional page in the informed consent, giving me the like the days that I was receiving this thing in the mail and the day that they wanted it back, and that they would have said there and then make sure you are at the post office before three. I think my it would have been much easier for me to stay in the trial, because now it just sort of came, and every other week I was like, oh yeah, another thing in the mail. So even those highly, highly, highly operational things that have nothing to do with the science or the medical side of the things, impact the patient experience. And
To as somebody leading now in site and patient engagement inside of a large pharma, I imagine a lot of this for you will be around insights and bringing those into study teams. But to a certain amount, there needs to be empathy so that people look at those insights and internalize them to be able to take action based on them.
That is
You know, we
exactly
talked a
right.
little bit about simulation and lived
Yeah.
experience. Are there pathways to be able to bring more of our study teams into that experience?
I think there are different ways of doing that then, and I like to separate the discussion, because what is scientifically necessary to prove the point of a protocol can't be jeopardized. All the nice to haves from a scientific point of view, we should be discussing them. All the but then you end up with a scientific optimized protocol. And then the next step should be a very conscious step. How do I operationally optimize my protocol? And that, I think, is a step where we as an industry have some work to do. And I know that at a lot of sites, it happens at a site level. And when I was an investigator, I know we did a full walkthrough of the protocol of a patient day. We had like a nurse simulate the what does it mean for a patient, and what are the things in the trial days that we need to take care of and we need to be aware of. And I really see an opportunity that we take the operational impact of our protocols more serious without jeopardizing. I don't want to go into the discussions about the medical and the science and et cetera, but
Absolutely, yeah.
just operations. But if we have time, Greg, I would also really like to call out a positive of my experience, because I like to think that we can learn from successes and this
Absolutely.
investigating.
We're in our final few minutes. Please share.
Yeah, so this investigator group in the rheumatology department in Amsterdam was one of the things that they absolutely did so well was keep us informed as trial participants. There were regular newsletters, there were sessions after the first year, interim analysis with snacks and drinks, and a lay language presentation of why they did the trial, how they did it, who participated, what they were saying. They shared with us when they were at a conference. They shared with the patients the link to the presentation for those who wanted to know the full scientific story. The they were only literally a phone call away, which I also used, and they've also phoned us. But especially that information, those updates on the trial, and like really your important this is we're in this pandemic together, but for some people there is more at stake and there's more at risk, and you as a healthy control group are key to for us to understand. I mean, that just was such a pleasant experience. Yeah. And I'm not sure we always do that in the industry.
That's great feedback. We have just a couple of minutes left, and we are dropping this on Clinical Trials Day. One of the asks for Clinical Trials Day is to post a selfie with one of their little selfie signs. And one of the prompts on that selfie sign is, "My clinical research superpower is dot dot dot." And so maybe in our little speed round here in our final moments, we can go around the room. I would love to hear what your clinical research superpower is. Craig, Sarah, can I put you on the spot? What is your superpower, my friend?
That's a great question. Certainly not coming up with a superpower, that's for sure. I would say the connecting piece of this, because it is incredibly our world is incredibly sort of shielded from most of the population. If you ask most people what a clinical trial is, you typically don't get an answer that is remotely correct, and it shouldn't be, because we are in a very sort of niche industry. And so the ability to connect people with trials or get them to the right investigators or physicians, I would say, is something that I'm particularly interested and proud of.
You are well positioned for that, especially in a world where we often get so siloed in our roles, and we kind of end up with a bit of these blinders and lose that lateral vision to be able to make great connections for folks across. Thank you for sharing that superpower, my friend. Tertu, so many superpowers I could assign to you. What is your clinical research superpower?
I like to think that I add to the industry ecosystem the voice of the investigator and the person who's lived it and who is seen it from so many different angles. And I like to be that superpower that continues to speak up on behalf of the people who execute our trials on a day-to-day basis and who work with the phenomenal patients who sign up to be participants. And that's what I would like to carry forward.
I think that is a fabulous power of yours, and I will add on my yes and to that is, and you do it by sharing it through with such inspiring voice. I'm looking forward to seeing your voice rise up again in my LinkedIn feed. It's a reminder for folks to make sure they're following all of these voices that we have with us here today, because they are truly inspired professionals. Stales, Alicia Staley, your clinical research superpower.
Well, probably tweeting. I don't, because that's how I connected with you all those years ago. Geez, I would probably say cheerleading a little bit, that I feel like in some ways in the last few years, I've really tried to take on a role of making sure that all these stakeholders are coming together to really be collaborative. So, sort of breaking down the walls, breaking down the barriers for making some of these connections, and just trying to bring some positivity to these conversations. So, yeah, that's what I'm going to stick with.
Thank you for doing what you do here, Alicia. We are very grateful. Jane Miles, did you have a clinical research superpower you can disclose? One of many?
I'll just say curiosity. Staying
Ooh, that's a good
curious
one.
lets me go places I never dreamed I would get there. So, and Craig, your superpower is clearly bringing together the experts in the room. So, thank you for doing all you do to help advance what we do together.
And I'm ending on time and on budget, Jane. So I'll claim that for today.
That's a
Thank you.
superpower.
On time, that it's the top of the hour. On budget, that I'm not paying any of you a dime. Thank you so much, Alicia, Tertu, Craig, for all that you do in this community. Honestly, you are fabulous voices, true leaders in this
Thank
space
you.
that bring authenticity and that generosity.